Right now, the National Toy and Miniature Museum here in Kansas City seems to be on a mission to bring back the game of marbles. Yes, they've got a marble exhibit on display for a whole year, but that's not all. They're also hosting regular game nights for grown-ups and training sessions for anyone who wants to become a Mibster. That's a marble player, a master marble player. So I've never played marbles myself, but I have to admit, I find it unlikely that Kansas City is going to bring back marbles in 2018. That being said, I really, really like the idea of Kansas City bringing back marbles in 2018, and I'm going to turn to an expert to get a better idea of why. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Scott Rice McBride, whose own collection of marble artifacts is in that Toy and Miniature Museum exhibit. He's also the author of not one, but two books on marbles. Hi, Scott. Welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Hello, Gina. Thank you for having me.
So just to start us off, what is your personal history with marbles?
Well, I've been a marble collector for over 50 years, and I got into marble collecting because I was a terrible marble player. And that way I didn't have to worry about losing them because I never risked them.
Okay, so that brings me to the point that there are probably people listening out there who don't know how this game is played. So can we work on spelling that out a little bit together? Because I did a little research, and I want you to tell me if I've got this right, okay?
Okay.
You make a circle out of some yarn if you're indoors, or with a stick in the dirt if you're playing outside, and everyone brings their own marbles. You put some of the marbles inside the circle, and then everyone has one marble called a shooter. Your shooter is probably your favorite marble and your biggest one?
It is not necessarily your biggest, but it's probably your favorite. It's the one that just feels right to you.
Okay. So then what you're trying to do with the shooter is, you know, you put it in one hand outside the circle, and then you put at least one knuckle touching the ground, knuckling down.
Correct.
And then you flick it in, and you try to knock the other marbles out.
And you try to knock other marbles out of the ring.
So that you can either be playing for keeps or playing for fun.
Right. For keeps meant you got to keep any marbles you knocked out of the ring. So when you knuckled down, and the game you described is called Ringer, just one of thousands of games that can be played with marbles.
Oh, so there isn't a game of marbles. There are many games of marbles.
There are many games of marbles. Prior to national marble tournaments being formed, marble games were by neighborhood. Kids made up their own games. What you're talking about is what's called a container game, where all the marbles are in one spot. You could play a game of chase where you shot marbles down a street and followed each other trying to hit marbles on the street. So you could go a long way from home doing that. Kids would play that going to and from school. The Ringer is a playground-type game where you played in a confined area.
So this whole thing of playing for keeps, I think it's sort of shocking to modern sensibilities. Like kids today, and kids when I was growing up too, I mean, you didn't go to school with your beloved toys and maybe not come home with them, all according to fair rules of play at the playground.
Well, things have changed in the last several years about the attitude of play. You know, that you risked your favorite marbles. Although you probably didn't risk your favorite shooter. That never, ever got put up for the risk.
Is that part of why you probably use the shooter as a favorite so that you wouldn't be risking it?
Correct.
So then the other thing that kind of strikes me about this is that, you know, play comes with a lot of gear now. You know, you have to use either some technological device, or there's just a lot of accessories and equipment and marbles. Once you have the marbles, everything else is just, it's kind of makeshift. You get a piece of yarn, you make it yourself.
You make it yourself, you use your own imagination. You learn negotiation skills when you played marbles because you had to negotiate the rules with the other players, because you can't have two people playing a game of marbles or six people playing a game of marbles and not know what the rules are. So you learn to negotiate. You also learn to remediate when there was conflicts. You know, just like any game, if I interpret the rules one way and you interpret them another, one of us is not going to agree with the decision. So you learn to mediate that way.
You know, so you personally have this huge collection of marbles and marble artifacts, and you've amassed a huge wealth of knowledge about marble tournaments from history. which that's what your books are about. Uh-huh. What inspired all of that collecting and that research? This is such, it could be seen as such a small part of daily life that people don't give much thought to.
And they don't really. Well, how I got started digging deeper into marble tournaments, a few years ago I went to a marble show where marble collectors get together and buy, sell, and trade marbles. And this one was in Omaha. And while I was there, one of the people that I knew says, let's go out to Boys Town. We went out to the Boys Town Museum and we're visiting with one of the curators. And he says, we've got a drawer full of pictures back here when we had a national marble tournament. He shared them with us and actually gave us copies. And one of the things that came out of that was I decided to see if I could find the young man that won that tournament.
What year was the tournament?
1947, and it was the first VFW national tournament.
Why did you want to find him?
Curiosity. Part of my collection has always been marble medals and marble trophies. So I just thought I'd see if I could find him. After about 6 months of trying to find him, I actually did find him, got to interview him, and I was going to do a presentation to another marble collectors group about his story. He was 12 years old when he went to the national tournament, and he was from Old Hickory, Tennessee. So he and his mother went by train from Old Hickory to Omaha. He probably would have never left home if he hadn't won the marble tournament and been able to qualify to go to the national. And he told stories about what the trip was like and what it was like playing marbles. And a lot of the newspaper articles I'd been given were backed up everything he said. So he had a very good memory of how things went on. He passed away shortly before he was almost 80 years old, and he passed away shortly before I did the presentation. And one of the things that kind of hit home was we're losing these stories. It's not an important national story. It's not something that's going to be recorded forever. And I decided to go ahead and see if I could record some more stories besides just his. And that's the basis for the big book I have.
Yeah, I mean, what do these stories mean to you? The big book you have, I mean, okay, you have two books, a slender volume about Marble King marble tournaments from 1935 to 1940, and then a meatier book, like a very meaty book, on VFW tournaments from 1947 to 1962. When you think about the significance of these tournaments, not just for their own sake, but when you do think about what they say either about America or about play, what stands out to you?
Well, things that stand out to me is these were opportunities for the kids of the time to get to go places they might normally not get to go. You know, you think about in the case of Ray Warren, who was the first champion, he had never left Old Hickory, Tennessee. He probably would not have left Old Hickory, Tennessee if it had not been for the marble tournament.
And marbles, I mean, I get the idea that they have always been fairly accessible, that it's not something that only, you know, wealthy kids could get their hands on.
That's right. And if you got to be good enough, you actually could earn marbles as part of the game. That's why you played for keeps. One family that I interviewed for the tournament actually had, between first cousins, had six state champions. They got into marble playing so that they could have slingshot ammunition. They wanted to shoot the marbles out of their slingshot, and it was easier to go to the playgrounds and win them on Saturday morning than it was to go buy them because they didn't have the money to buy marbles.
It does sound a lot like little kids were basically gambling.
Yes, it was a form of gambling because you had to risk for the reward.
Well, so that notwithstanding, I mean, some aspects of marbles are timeless, which I want to get into in a second, but you write that a lot of boys born in the 1930s had grown up in wartime without a male influence in their homes. And you say these tournaments filled that void?
Well, think of the men returning from war. You know, many of the young men at the time, the boys that were playing in these tournaments, had been without a lot of male leadership. So now the VFW, with the members of the VFW and the men returning from war, were organizing these tournaments. So they were giving a positive male leadership to a lot of these boys.
Marbles, in some form or another, have been around since the beginning of play. It seems that way anyway. They've been found at archaeological sites around the world in clay and wood and stone. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, if you think about it, it's a simple toy. I mean, to make a marble, all you had to do was roll up a ball of clay or pick up a nut like an acorn or something semi-round, and you could play games with it. And that's probably how it got started.
So are we the generation that killed a childhood tradition that transcended political boundaries, time and space for thousands and thousands of years?
I don't know that we've killed it, but we certainly have damaged it.
How did we do that?
Well, there's a couple things that go on. One, the type of play has changed. Kids have much more stimulation now, electronic stimulation, than they had back in the 50s. When I was growing up, I remember having one TV station. And if there was a storm going on, you didn't watch TV because the station disappeared on you. Kids went outside and played on their own much more than they do now. I remember my school playground was a dirt playground. So you could go out and you could draw a marble circle. Well, once it got paved over, you can't do that around schools where you've got asphalt playgrounds. You know, just not as much free time. I think kids don't have as much free time. You know, my grandchildren go out and they are organized with what they're doing, when they're doing it. There's always activities planned for them. Whereas 50 years ago, I didn't have activities planned for me. It was get out of the house and go play.
What have we lost other than maybe one particular game?
Oh, I think we've probably lost some innocence. We've lost some of the imagination that kids use to play marbles. That's why every neighborhood had a different marble game, is because the imagination, you know, whether it was throwing the marbles and trying to hit them at a long distance or drawing a square instead of a circle to play marbles in, it was just...
Yeah, I'm struck by it that, you know, there are games that kids all over this country and probably beyond are playing identically today. Because, I don't know, there are ways of getting out very specific rules and sharing secrets, and that the idea that neighborhood to neighborhood, a game would have been different and reinvented by different groups of kids, that is sort of a novel concept to me.
Well, again, it's because we didn't have that mass communications we have now. You know, when kids were growing up in the 20s, 30s, 40s, even into the 50s, you might not go to the town next to you that might be 5-6 miles away, except maybe for very specific things. Every small community had a grocery store. Every small community had a hardware store. So you didn't have to go. You know, I grew up in a small town. Today, there's no grocery store. There's no hardware store. But they were all there when I was growing up. So now if you wanted to go to a grocery store from where I grew up, you have to travel almost 20 miles. So there's more interaction now than there was back then.
So we're not going to go back to another time, but what would you say is the first step in bringing back marbles?
Well, I think it's introducing kids to it, which we're doing at the museum, letting them realize that, hey, they can unplug, that they can actually enjoy some things where they get down on the ground and play marbles. We've had the opportunity to teach a lot of kids how to play marbles. Is it going to be the lifelong end-all game that was for a lot of these kids back in the 30s and 40s? Probably not, because once they get out of the marble ring and get home, it's the same stimulation they had before.
Well, Scott McBride, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Playing for Keeps is on view at the Toy and Miniature Museum into January of next year, so check their calendar for the game nights and Mibster training sessions if you are now convinced that we do, in fact, need to bring back marbles. After this break, KCUR's Central Standard will be back with a conversation about the movie I, Tonya. Class, gender, abuse, and fame all come together on the ice rink in Tonya Harding's story. Stay tuned. This is old TV footage from Tonya Harding making ice skating history in 1991. Listen to the announcer as Tonya glides onto the ice and begins her routine.
Great power, great speed, and great athletic ability. And the question is whether three moves into the program, She will do a triple axel. First, a triple Lutz. And now the question is whether she will become the first American to attempt and complete a triple axel jump. We will know that here, whether she tries it or not. Good girl! Oh, isn't that great?
What you are not seeing right now is the ice skater in a ponytail and seafoam dress breaking her composure just a little. A giant smile is erupting on her face. And in case you didn't catch this, she just became the first woman in America, the second woman in the world, to do a really difficult jump, like impossible practically, a triple axel in competition. But that is not what people remember about Tanya Harding. If they remember her at all, what they remember is a scandal. And the new movie, I, Tanya, really shames all of us for that. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about class, gender, abuse, and fame. They all come together on the ice rink in this story. My guests are a former ice skater, an advocate from a women's shelter, and a sociologist. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I will start by getting everyone's capsule review of the movie, and then we'll really dig in. Sociologist Michelle Smirnova with us from UMKC. What did the movie get right or wrong, and what did you leave the theater thinking about?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on today. I found the movie captured so many complex sociological processes between the relationships between culture and class and gender, as well as recurrent cycles of abuse, relationships between partner abuse and familial abuse. And the movie also directly addresses the audience as abusers, sort of the beginning of this cyberbullying, and normalizing a cycle of humor that takes aim at the working class, at a working class girl who endured incredible abuse at the hands of her own mother and spouse. So I think there's a lot to really unpack in this film. And I think it, while it left a lot of space for discussion outside of the theater, even if it didn't unpack all of these things explicitly on the screen.
All right, Scott Mason with us from the Rose Brooks Center. What did you think? How did I, Tanya, resonate or not for you?
You know, I knew going in what the reviews were and what the discussions were about domestic violence and her experience with that and family violence. And I wish I could say that every portrayal of domestic violence is a good discussion, but unfortunately, it's not. You know, it was mentioned, you know, this normalization of domestic violence, and especially when we infuse it with humor. And I think it confuses the audience on how to kind of really respond to that. And
so you think, I guess just to make it clear, it sounds like the pairing of these scenes with sort of some humor in narration or in just how the combination of humor and abuse, even though they don't usually happen in the same scene, that was still troubling.
It was troubling. And I think it would be troubling for any survivor of domestic violence. It's domestic violence is so extremely complex. It's impossible to portray it in a movie like I, Tanya in a healthy way that would elicit some discussion that's healthy for somebody who's trying to escape a domestic violence situation. But again, you know, I think anytime we have follow up discussions like this, that's the important part.
Well, we will definitely be getting to the abuse piece of it in more detail. But before we do that, I am joined now by a former ice skating Olympic hopeful, Banyan Lee. And Banyan, I am really curious about your review. What did you think of this movie?
So I thought this was the first time mass media has really peeled back the curtains behind figure skating, the sport itself, and the classism within figure skating, and how much that classism influenced the sport to this day.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think figure skating, when I was training, was the second most expensive sport to be in. And you had to come from a lot of wealth and privilege to afford the status that it took to win competitions. And what do I mean by that? You know, you would skate on the regional level with a skating club, and certain skating clubs were known for excellent skaters. And so you would have to find a coach from that skating club. Those coaches were more expensive, but you knew that if you were announced with that skating club behind your name, judges would take closer notice to you. So from a very young part of my life, I learned that politics was always ingrained in everything I did, because you could skate your heart out and still never meddle because you didn't have the right name attached and your family didn't have enough money to buy your way into those correct clubs and the right kind of outfits. And I think they touched on that a lot in how expensive the dresses were.
Yeah, you see Tanya sewing her own but kind of suffering the consequences, yes, in terms of not like eventually when she's sort of famous in public shaming, but early on and not getting those medals.
Yeah. I think this was the first look at really that class structure within the sport. It's always presented on the Olympic scene and you always see, these very young girls, pristine, and you see them in the kiss and cry and you see them at their best moments. But what's never talked about is some of the uglier sides of the sport and the access issues that exist.
Ice skating is this unusual sport. I mean, I was thinking about this. Diving and gymnastics are this way too, but you don't win by crossing a finish line first. There is not an objective, clear-cut measure of victory. It is by getting good scores from judges who are human beings and therefore susceptible to being total jerks.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Also, having bias is another way of putting that. Can you talk to us as a former ice skater about that experience, what that's like, just your own experience with it?
Yeah, I remember from a very young time that my mom would always say, "Are you sure you don't want to go play golf? Are you sure you don't want to go play another sport where, the ball clearly lands in a certain spot and it's very objective?" I think it was very hard for my parents to watch me go out at competitions and skate wonderfully and not necessarily place the places that I needed to be because I was from Kansas City, not from a great, club that was known for good skaters. And so, there's always this piece of politics and piece of notoriety that comes with each skater that has nothing to do with athleticism or artistry. I think they've tried to tweak the way they judge over the years to try and take a little bit of that subjective aspect out of the sport, but it's always going to be there. And that's what I loved about this movie is that it really did talk about just how subjective and how political that sport can be.
She confronts a judge. Mm-hmm. Did you find that surprising?
I mean, I don't think I found it surprising for Tanya Harding from what we knew of her. I didn't know her personally. But that was definitely always a no-no. you never socialized with judges. There was a national judge or two here locally in Kansas City, and they would come to the rink, and there were aspects of coaches talking to judges and getting to know them, and networking. But I found it surprising. I don't think it's something that many skaters did. It was always an unspoken rule that you just didn't do that.
The ideals of figure skating are sort of complicated, too. Like, it seems like this is a sport where it's not just, on the one side, these are athletes and they're expected to be powerful and like forces of nature. But on the other hand, there's this idea of we're looking for grace and we're looking for someone gentle and someone who embodies this kind of other feminine ideal that it's kind of at odds with, there are athletes out there in sports who shamelessly grunt throughout their public performances. A skater really can't pull that off. And Tanya Harding is an interesting case in that she kind of tried.
Yeah, I think no matter where you land on Tanya Harding and how much you think she's involved in the scandal, I think some things ring really true and are very consistent, which is figure skating can be looked at from the standpoint of gender norms and what females are expected to be in the public eye. And this movie really challenges that look. It forces us to all look at a sport that men and women adore and love to watch. But you do watch this movie and stop and think, are females being held to this standard that we're now talking more about in society within this sport? Tanya Harding, when I was watching the movie, there were some previews before the movie and after the movie where they showed her jumps and her performances. And I just remember sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, she was such a good skater. Her athleticism was unmatched. But that was never talked about. And I think in figure skating, even to this day, media insists on pitting females against one another, drawing out the scandal between the female skaters, the female athletes.
Yeah, Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan.
I think the media really loved seeing two women fight. And I think there's something to be talked about there. You know, in this time when we're having much discussion about gender disparities and how women are portrayed in media, I think iTanya is a great case study for that.
I want to bring Michelle Smirnova back in here. You know, that tension between athleticism and grace and the idea that, you know, that we even at the time couldn't really just focus on Tanya Harding being a great skater, even before the Nancy Kerrigan scandal. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. And I think, Banya, you brought up a lot of really great points about sort of these, how the conflation of gender in this sport. And Jean, I think you brought up this point of the feminine ideal and this grace. And we see how this feminine ideal is tied to a particular articulation of class and gender performance, where women are expected to be frail and beautiful and must be protected. And Tanya refused to do that. And we see how this is tied very much to her life of abuse, that she refused to be a victim. But it's important for us to unpack what is grace, what is this high class, that figure skating is, as the initial audio we heard of the announcer and this description of Tanya, that she was perhaps the best skater in the world technically at the time, but that she's in figure skating, you're also scored based on your performance. And this performance we think of as an objective thing, that this is class, this is grace, that this is something we can objectively measure. But that often these things come from particular class articulations. Pierre Bourdieu is a sociologist who talks about social class, and that we think of it as purely economic terms, how much money you have. But Nancy Kerrigan and Tanya Harding both came from working class backgrounds. And yet, part of class is who you associate with, so your social capital, but also your cultural capital, the way you walk, the way you talk, the way you dress. And Tanya Harding was proudly brash. She confronted judges. She sewed her own costumes. And also in terms of what skating clubs you're affiliated with, this could be your social capital. So she did not have the cultural capital that Nancy Kerrigan had. And in addition,
including the family. I mean, we see that when she confronts a judge, what he tells her, spoiler alert, is that, you know, you're going to represent America if you're in the Olympics, and we want this great family story. And she can't help it. She does not have that great family story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And she's unapologetic about it. She says, that's not who my family is. And so that's where I thought the humor element, while felt inappropriate in this dark humor and making humor of domestic abuse, that a lot of victims do deal with their abuse through humor. And also being unapologetic about this is the life that I've endured and I have survived, and I am a survivor more than anything else. But
back to these two women, Nancy Kerrigan and Tanya Harding, when you look back on it, how old do you remember this whole deal?
I do. I was in middle school, I believe. And I remember that class was not something that was so salient to me, because this was before I sort of became versed. I was a child. But I actually watched the ESPN did a documentary, a 30 for 30 documentary a couple years back also on Nancy Kerrigan and Tanya Harding. And class was the central component of that documentary. This is something I teach in my class about, that we talk about something being classy and something being trashy, as though these are objective measures. And I often show a picture of two sets of high heel pumps to the class, and I say, which ones are classy and which ones are trashy? And people, it's very easy. They can point, one are the classy and one are the trashy, and ask them why. They're both stiletto high heels. They're black. but one of them has a little buckle on it, and it's patent leather, and the other one is sparkly with glitter. And I say, well, why is one classy and one trashy? And inevitably, it comes back to who is wearing those heels. That one is associated with rich women lawyers, and another one is, well, those are stripper heels. And so we think of class as this, well, this is objectively graceful, but that we can trace it back that what is graceful is often tied to people with wealth, people with money.
Professions and things
like that. We want to represent America on the national stage, which is exactly what Tanya was penalized for.
Bunyan, what do you remember about all of, about in the 90s when this was all happening, how you viewed the Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan scandal just as an American viewer who happened to be an ice skater?
Yeah, I found myself at the end of the movie feeling a little bit ashamed of how I looked at it. I was 14 years old during that Olympics. I was in the rise of my own career and hadn't yet learned to think critically about gender norms and the role females played in the public eye. And so I just remember it being a scandal. I do remember there was a part of me, and I think it's the feminist part of me deep down inside that's always been there, that didn't really feel too much. I didn't feel very sorry for Nancy. I mean, it was horrible what happened to her. But
so
I also...
In case people don't actually remember what happened, she was... Now, this is an interesting thing. Even now, when I read different articles about what happened, they differ a lot.
Yes, yeah.
But basically, she was attacked with a club of some kind,
yeah,
either in the kneecap or the thigh. Those determinations differ, but she was captured this was on television nationally saying, why, mm-hmm, why? And people used to kind of joke, people made fun of her too, making fun of her saying why, while she's just been attacked as she prepares for the Olympics. But it's kind of interesting, you know, like.
Yeah.
This all happened, in a way that implicated strongly, if not Tanya Harding, at least her husband,
right,
who turns out to have been abusive, and others.
Yeah, I remember feeling distinctly one kind of way when she stood on the podium. And I thought the movie brought that out. When the movie talked about that, I could really relate with that sentiment. She kind of had a scowl on her face.
When Nancy Kerrigan stood on the podium get a silver medal.
And didn't win gold. And I thought what that brought out, it really didn't have anything to do with Nancy. I think what happened to her was awful. And I wouldn't want to wish that on anybody. But I think what that points out is the entitlement that we see in figure skating a lot with the girls that are competing and the women that are competing. There is a sense of entitlement from a lot of these competitors. The majority of competitors come from wealth or privilege by anybody's standards. And I think there is this piece that, you know, that a lot of them feel entitled to a gold medal or entitled to feel like they should be placing on that podium. And so that's what I meant by I think I felt it in that moment when I watched the medal ceremony that year. And I don't remember how I felt necessarily about Tanya Harding. I think that it was a scandal and it was juicy to watch. And I had all those, you know, reactions that everyone had at the time.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, looking back on, there were, and they showed this in the movie, there were David Letterman top 10 lists making fun of Tanya Harding. There were... She was kind of the butt of a national joke. And what do you think that joke was about, whether you take the movie into account in answering this question or not?
Well, actually, one of my areas of research is about humor and which topics are considered appropriate for humor are really telling because they show what is how victims are constructed in our culture. So would you laugh at an impoverished victim of parental and spousal abuse? Of course not. But laughing at Tanya Harding, sure. They made jokes on Seinfeld, SNL. Obama even made a reference in one of his speeches recently. So very lasting shelf life. Would you laugh at a girl whose boss, twice her age, engaged her in sexual acts? Absolutely not. Monica Lewinsky? Sure. Would you laugh about rape? No. Prison rape? Well, just don't drop the soap. And we think about why. Why are some of these things absolutely off limits and these certain people are okay? And this is really tied to how our culture constructs the victim as potentially deserving the abuse that comes to them, that they deserve some sort of punishment. And this is how we construct incarcerated people in this country, as well as the way Tonya Harding was constructed, that she was a villain, and so she was worth this punishment.
What do you remember about the Tonya Harding story? And do you question that now? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're going to delve more into the abuse piece of this story when we return. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with former ice skater Bonyan Lee, Rose Brooks Center advocate Scott Mason, and sociologist Michelle Smirnova. We're talking about Tonya Harding, thanks to the new movie putting her story in a different light. It's called I, Tonya. Hi again, everyone.
Hi.
So, Scott, you know, we've touched a lot on the idea that Tonya Harding was abused. A lot of people listening probably don't know that piece of the story or don't know it well. So pick this thread up for us. Tonya, according to this movie, was really horribly abused, not just by her mom, but by her husband. Can you describe a little bit the kinds of things we're talking about?
Sure. And I'm definitely old enough to remember this story, and I don't recall hearing a lot about the abuse that happened to Tonya in the media, which is unfortunate. But she definitely endured years of verbal and emotional abuse from her mother from a very early age, and they portrayed it as if her father was maybe the healthy parent in that relationship who left when she was young, but endured a lot of verbal and emotional abuse, and then obviously physical abuse from her mother from a very early age, and that continued, obviously. And then in the relationship with her boyfriend and future husband, very much the same as we see typical in a lot of abusive relationships in the cycle of abuse. It started slow. It started with verbal and emotional and turned into physical as more control was needed in that relationship.
Her husband, Jeff Galluli, the guy who... So eventually when Nancy Kerrigan is attacked, it turns out to have been a plot that involved him and a friend of his. And people were really skeptical about people considered it implausible that Tonya Harding would not have been in cahoots with this guy. But the way the movie portrays it, you know, she was probably scared for her own safety. Like, going forward and saying what this guy did, he was her abuser, too.
I would agree.
You know, so while the American public at the time found it implausible that she wasn't in cahoots, do you?
No, I don't find it implausible. I don't believe that she had any indication that that was happening. And a lot of times in abusive relationships, there's so much coercion going on that the victim doesn't know about. So I believed Tonya. You know, that was one of the redeeming things that I found about this movie, is that we were able to allow Tonya to almost heal. And, you know, and you see it in interviews even today as she's interviewed, it's almost the healing is continuing for Tonya because there's this validation that she has finally believed that she was a victim, which is one of the hallmarks of what we tell people, is to believe and validate somebody who discloses to you that they're in an abusive relationship.
She makes this comment at one point, and these are based on they're actors, but what they're saying is based on interviews that the filmmakers did with the real people involved.
Right.
So the Tonya character she says, you know, Nancy gets hit one time and the whole world cries for her. And this was just like a normal everyday occurrence for me, and basically nobody cared.
That's right. One of the most powerful scenes in the movie to me was when they got pulled over by the police and there was blood dripping down her face, and
with her husband driving the car.
Correct. And there was no indication in the retelling of that story that, you know, she was offered any help. You know, she was victimized by every single person. So for her to make that statement about Nancy, I'm sure it had a lot to do with a lot of resentment from her own experiences with never being believed or validated. But then, you know, her perception was that, of course, we're going to believe Nancy because she's the privileged one and she's the one that people are going to feel sorry about.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on that as well, that we've talked about it as domestic abuse for a really long time, and that language in of itself relegates it to the private sphere, that this is personal, troubled, we're not going to deal with it, and that quote that Nancy gets hits one time and the whole world cries, and that there's so many women who deal with this on a daily basis and get no recognition because it's a personal matter. And I think we think of this scandal at the same time as O.J. Simpson and JonBenet Ramsey. And O.J. Simpson, with the recent sort of film looking back on this, tells a very similar story of how many times Nicole called the police and the police saw that she had her head bashed in and walked away. And so how many people are complicit in partner abuse, and that this is a public issue, not a private issue.
Absolutely.
Well, and in this case, there's also the public was directly involved in that this was happening on the national media stage as well. There, one of the people interviewed was a reporter from Hard Copy who, you know, you see that she's holed up in her home while there are reporters sitting outside, and she runs out at one point because her truck is being towed, and he reveals, oh yeah, sometimes I'd go have her truck towed so that I could get a shot of her running out of the house and things like that, you know, that she was, when she makes that comment, you were all my abusers, she doesn't mean that entirely metaphorically.
Oh, absolutely not. She, that was another powerful line of the movie, you know, and I remember reeling from that comment while watching the movie because I, like many of us, victimized her during that period because we believed what we were being told. And we weren't being told of the horrors of her relationships and her past. And but yeah, she definitely was being victimized by every single individual, whether that was the police, her family. And you know, and it's so common for survivors to be victimized by the people that are closest to them. It's a strange occurrence, but our response to somebody who discloses abuse oftentimes is either disbelief because, you know, he or she would never hurt you, you know, we have shared families, you know, so it's all these layers of complexity when you're trying to disclose abuse, and there are so many reasons why a victim or a survivor will stop disclosing at some point or stop having faith in the system because they're not being believed or validated or offered any support.
And you mentioned earlier that the humor in this movie really bothered you. And thinking back on the movie, I think that usually that where that gets combined with abuse is in the character of the mother who, as an older woman, is retelling her version of the story. And she makes comments that are so out of touch with reality and so glaringly out of touch with reality that you do kind of almost laugh at her, but it also really captures her meanness.
Yeah, I think the only reason why I personally had difficulty with the humor is because I'm an advocate for domestic violence. I want others to, you know, I found myself in this moment wanting to stand up and educate everybody on the real dynamics of domestic violence. And I understand the importance of humor, and I understand the importance of laughing as we're going through some of those experiences ourselves, as Michelle was talking about, how humor can play an important role of somebody's healing. But I found it uncomfortable because there are so many misunderstandings of why somebody stays in a relationship or why somebody would choose, using quotes, to stay in that relationship.
Does the laughter kind of let us off the hook from thinking about that?
Yeah. I was afraid that was what was happening, I guess, was why I was uncomfortable with it.
The whole movie starts with what I thought personally was maybe one of the most problematic lines, which was just words on the screen saying, this is based on real, totally unironic interviews with all of the people involved. And I felt like the need to say that the interviews were unironic almost was a nudge, nudge, wink, wink kind of thing.
Yeah, I would agree.
So, Bonian, we've been talking about abuse, and I know that that's not what you're here to talk about, but in sports, I mean, you were talking about this movie really peeled back the curtain on the world of figure skating. There is, you know, coaching is intense. Parents' relationships with their kids when they're succeeding at these high levels can be intense. And I wonder what you can tell us just about that. Can that just be part of this world?
Unfortunately, it is part of this world. And I think that's why this conversation has to happen. I think that the figure skating community, the international figure skating community, and the U.S. figure skating community should really stop in this moment and have a conversation. I was in skating rinks all my life where there were elite skaters who were suffering abuse at the hands of their parents, international figure skating teams who suffered abuse at the hands of their coaches, all to attain this gold medal and the endorsements and the money that it comes with. And never was there ever any dialogue about abuse, healthy relationships, and even healthy ways to go about training your body. It was getting that gold medal at all costs, no matter what. I was lucky enough to come from a family that would never stand for that. I mean, it was all about if you're not having fun and you're not healthy, we're not doing this. And so my family drew a lot of healthy boundaries. And I remember as a young person looking at the other things that I saw and witnessed, thinking that is messed up. And I think that if the Tonya Harding story were to play out today, I hope that it would play out differently with the dialogue that we're having as a society, the reckoning that we're having with abusers, and that Tonya's story would be heard a little bit more, and there would be more balance to that story. Again, no matter where you land on this, on what you think her culpability was in that whole situation, I definitely believe that that story was not told equally. I agree with Scott. I don't ever remember hearing about the abuse that she suffered behind the scenes. That was never talked about, nor would it have been okay to talk about. There's so much stigma about abuse and domestic abuse. And
people might not have known, but what shocks me is she was so young and that no one asks the question. She's surrounded clearly by people who are at least on some level violent, and no one's asking the question, are you okay? She's showing up at competitions in self-assembled rabbit fur coats that she has skinned those rabbits herself. No one's asking, are you okay?
Yeah, because it's not about whether you're okay. It's about how you skate, how you look, how you sound, how you act in the kiss and cry area, and ultimately whether you win. And I think now is the time to have this conversation. If this movie is going to do any good, I think it is to start a dialogue about the figure skating world. We're seeing the gymnastics world have this dialogue now with Larry Nassar's conviction and his abuse of, 150 gymnasts. So I think it's time for the figure skating world to have that conversation.
There's a line from toward the end of the movie, and again, this is in spoiler territory because it is from the end, but she says, Americans want someone to love, we want someone to hate, and we want it easy. That line killed me because, you know, like, that's true whether we're talking about the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan story or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think we want to project this American ideal that less than 1% of Americans, if that, even have. And it's a myth. And we saw that very much play out in this film.
Well, our time is up, but this has been a really interesting conversation. The movie is packed full of ideas. If you haven't seen it already, it's definitely interesting. Bonian Lee, former figure skater, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Scott Mason, Michelle Smirnova, thank you both.
Thank you.
And this has been a Screen Time conversation about I, Tonya. You can listen back to it at your leisure at kcur.org/centralstandard. Keep tweeting your questions and reviews. We're at KCURCST. Tomorrow, is there a future for undeveloped land in prime locations? Parkville is wrestling with that question right now. Tune in to hear more tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. And Up to Date is next. So stick around for that. Steve Kraske will be hosting.